Well, excited to this week and next week as well to, if you see me, I'm going to keep doing this morning. I'm trying a new brand of contacts and I'm finding that it's a little blurry. And so it's like not working here. But this morning and next week, we're going to try a new kind of message and we'll kind of see how it goes. And if we like it, maybe we'll do it every once in a while, kind of like we do our New Year's nuggets for those who have been around. If it's terrible, well, you know, we tried, and we'll never do it again, and please don't hold it against me. But, you know, you got to try new things sometimes. You can't be afraid to fail. So I am titling this kind of genre of message, if you will, What's Right, What's Wrong? Where we look at a common statement or saying or something that's been said a lot recently, something that has maybe been circulated kind of around a teaching or way of thinking, and we examine what's right about this statement from a biblical perspective, and then also what's wrong about this statement in light of what the scriptures say. And a lot of life is really lived and articulated in this kind of complex middle, where the answer isn't always easy. You know, I think as humans in our flesh, we want easy answers. And especially in today's world, we want, you know, short, simple sayings, kind of quick maxims to live by. We want our wisdom to come in, you know, bite-sized social media posts that we can easily digest, rather than maybe thoughtfully thinking through the complexities of an issue or reading, say, a whole article or even a book. I don't know if you remember what those look like, but they're kind of bigger. Instead, we often form our opinions on, you know, a quick one-liner or, you know, a Facebook or post or Instagram feed, and we just kind of assume it's right because it sounds good or sounds wise on the surface. But the truth is, life is kind of much more complex than that in a lot of ways, and answers aren't always easy and sometimes require wisdom. And so, sort of as a way of introduction to this type of message and its theme and what I've just said about how life isn't always divided into, you know, kind of this is right, this is wrong, let's visit our first statement of this message and look at what's right and what's wrong with this first statement, which also kind of introduces kind of this way of thinking. So the statement is, reading the Bible is not complicated. You just do what it says. Alternatively, this is often said as, you know, the Bible says what it means and means what it says. So let's talk about what's right about this statement. There are some very straightforward and easy answers in the Bible that we don't really have to debate too much, right? I mean, the Ten Commandments, they're just the Ten Commandments. Jesus being the way and the truth and the life, and nobody coming to the Father except through him, and the only way of being saved, there's no debate. Salvation is through Christ alone. And there are some other great simple teachings throughout the Bible, quick summaries, such as the two great commandments, where Jesus tells us that here's the most important command, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And I find that so reassuring and nice to know, right, that here's how you should spend most of your time and energy on these two things that really summarize a lot of the teachings of the Bible, loving God and loving neighbor. I love that simplicity. Or the golden rule in Luke 6:31, right? Do to others as you would have them do to you. Treat others the way you want to be treated. How about Philippians 2:14? Do everything without grumbling or without complaining. Pretty straightforward. I don't know about you, I've yet to master this verse and feel like, you know, I almost shouldn't read anything else in the Bible until I just, you know, focus in on this, lean in to this simple teaching and try to get it under control in my life to do everything without complaining. I pretty much follow the opposite advice. I do everything with complaining, pretty much opposite of the Bible. And, you know, no offense, so do you. I've seen your post. You know, I know what you do. So the Bible does have some very simple yet challenging truths and teachings that don't need a lot of explanation. And our list could go on. Most of us could spend our whole lives trying to master these few things and never really arrive. And one of the reasons I love the Bible is honestly, a lot of it is just easy enough for a three-year-old to grasp, my own three-year-olds. And that's why we often say, hey, reading the Bible is not complicated. You just do what it says. There's some basic stuff in there. And yet, the Bible is also complex enough to spend your entire life studying, and it never gets old and never gets boring. So let's talk about kind of what's wrong with this statement of saying, hey, reading the Bible, not complicated, you just do what it says. It says what it means what it says. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the Bible is a really big book. Like, this is not bite-sized literature here. Why is that? Because life is really complicated and complex. And the Bible reflects that. This is not some easy answer book. And although I just gave you a few examples of when it nicely summarizes or condenses some teaching, it's not primarily a bunch of bullet point propositions that quickly tell us all we need to know and what we need to do, and then we kind of move on. I mean, God could have done it that way. Do you ever think about that? I think about this all the time. Like, he could have gave us 5 pages. He could have gave us 1 book. He could have just gave us 1 gospel, even. A couple of stories, and said, you know, master these and you're good. But instead, it encompasses all the challenges, complexities, feelings, emotions, joys, and pains of what it means to be human. The Bible invites us into a story of the human experience, and it invites conversation and discussion and prayer and reflection, and most of all, causes us to call out in wisdom to God, saying, I need your help to be obedient. The Bible is mostly made up of story. It's mostly narrative. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but those stories rarely say or conclude, in light of this, do this. Or the moral of the story of Samson is, or based upon Jacob's life, here's 3 takeaways. It just rarely does that. I wish it did, make preaching a lot easier. But rather, these stories invite discussion and reflection, and they call for careful discernment. And in fact, you know, Jesus tells us point blank that he speaks mostly in parables or stories, so that only those who really desire the way of the kingdom, who are really willing to lean in and do the hard work of the heart, who are hungry, only they will actually really get it. I mean, he basically says he conceals truth from those who just want easy answers and aren't interested in doing the hard work of unearthing the deeper layers in our hearts. I mean, anyone can master information. Anyone can master propositions, bullet points of truth, say they believe in God or believe the right things or maybe even follow the Ten Commandments. Although Jesus challenges even that by getting to the heart of the commandments in his teaching. But Jesus rarely teaches in a way that just rewards knowing the right information or doing just the simple things. For example, he says to the Pharisees in Luke chapter 11, verse 42, he says, "Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs." So they tithe, and he says, that's great, but you neglect justice and love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. So Jesus says, yeah, you should be doing the simple things, the good works, like tithing all that you have to God. You know, that's kind of the easy part. Start there. But a heart of love and concern of others which is actually more difficult, honestly requires a lot more than just writing a check for 10% of your income. Learning to love God and others is kind of less black and white. It's a little more complex. It's a little more messy. But these are the weightier matters of the law. Most of the Christian life can't be lived just by knowing the right information, mastering information. Otherwise, of course, it would be a lot easier. But the Christian life is kind of difficult because it is lived dependent on the Spirit for wisdom and all the complexities of life that we're going to face. And I love the definition of wisdom kind of inspired by Walter Brueggemann, and it's one of my kind of go-tos or favorites. And he says that wisdom is the patient sorting out of what leads to life and what doesn't. The patient sorting out of what leads to life and what doesn't. It takes wisdom and often time and thoughtfulness and reflection to figure out what leads to life and ultimately what leads to the greater glory of God in the world and in our lives. And that's why I think kind of this what's right, what's wrong style of message actually has some merit. That it's a way of starting a conversation of discernment, of thinking, okay, when it comes to these statements or ways of living or maxims, what leads actually to the most life, to more love of God and love of neighbor? And the answer isn't always easy. We have to think through it and study the scriptures and prayerfully reflect and seek counsel from those who maybe have wisdom or have spent their lives or education thinking about these things. So that's sort of kind of a introductory way of thinking about this whole idea of what's right and what's wrong by discussing what's right and what's wrong with this statement of reading the Bible is not complicated, you just do what it says. And we see there's some merit to that, some really good things about that that we can take away, but there's also some things kind of missing, we would say, maybe from that statement, that it's too simplified in some ways. So let's try this out on one more topic or a common saying, and then we'll do a few more next week, and then we'll move on, and we'll see if this was a good idea or not to do this. But thanks for being willing to try something new. But here's something that I've heard a lot lately during the pandemic, so it's quite relevant, and we want to explore, hey, what's good? There's a lot of good to this, and maybe what's wrong or what's missing from this. So the statement is, the church is not a building. Similar statements that have become popular during the pandemic is, we don't need a building to worship God, or God doesn't reside in a building. He lives in our hearts. He's not confined to a place. So let's talk about what's right about this statement. That statement is absolutely true, right? The church is not a building, never should be confined to a building. The church is the people of God. We don't go to church. We are the church everywhere we go and everywhere we are. And if we confine our definition of church, of where we worship, to a place or a building or what we do on Sunday, we are certainly in error. We can and should worship anywhere and everywhere. In a lot of ways, one place is not really more sacred than another. But what I've seen in how people are often using this statement and sort of sometimes abusing its truthfulness is it's mostly being used lately to say, we don't really need to gather together in any sort of way, in any kind of formal worship. I can worship at home, I can occasionally get a few people together, and that'll kind of be church. And to be honest, sometimes it's mostly used kind of as an excuse to do our own thing, not to enter into the difficulty of community and accountability and forsake the often messy road of Christian discipleship, which is done in community amongst other sinful people that you don't always get to choose who they are, which you can be very selective when it's just a few of you. And in essence, a lot of what people are saying when they're saying this is that they're defining their faith mostly as a personal, somewhat private thing between a person and God. And that's why it's so popular That's why people really like this. That's why it gets, you know, a lot of likes on Facebook or a lot of comments when people kind of say this. Because the world loves this definition of faith as a private activity. Right? They say, hey, that's great and that's good for you, but it doesn't need to impact anyone else. We don't need to publicly do anything about it. It's just what about, you know, it's about if that works in your heart and your kind of private faith and devotion, hey, that's great. So let's talk about what's wrong with this statement and some of its implications of the church is not a building. So the church, which is, of course, is a biblical word and idea, is by very definition a physical public gathering. The most common term for church in the Bible is ecclesia. And it just means ek, which is out of, and kaleo, to call. So it literally means to call out of our own personal, individual lives and spaces and to gather together into assembly. That's what the word church means. So we can't be the church, according to the Bible's definition, if we're not being called out of our normal lives and routines and the things we do all the time into a sacred space and physical place and time together. And so I realize now with, you know, online and digital church, things that we are thankful for and we embrace, that technically, you know, we can worship at any time. On-demand worship, so to speak, that's available all week, any time, any day. And there's definitely some good and awesome things about that, some of which I'll discuss maybe next week. But for 2,000 years, the church has gathered together physically in real time together. And you might know the words from Hebrews chapter 10, 24 and 25 that says, let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together, the gathered community, the church, as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and especially all the more as you see the day, meaning the day of the Lord, approaching. So Hebrews 10:25 tells us that gathering together is just really not optional for any serious Christian. So yes, we're called to be the church everywhere we go. But in order to do that effectively, we need to gather as the church so that we might be united still when we then scatter as the church. So we can't be the church scattered without first being the church gathered. And so that's what we kind of call this room. If you see the signs above the door on the outside and inside when you come into the sanctuary, the sign when you leave says the church scattered. The sign right above the door where you come in says the church gathered. We never cease being the church. We're always the church. We're just either the church gathered or we are the church scattered. And there are serious consequences when we start to think of our Christian life and worship as a private matter, an individual pursuit confined to our personal spaces. Like the early church in the New Testament letters, we should be careful of the appealing yet deceiving, even if well-meaning, teachings out there that teach that the church doesn't need to gather to be the church, because it begins to lead to the assumption that Christianity is a private matter, something people do in the privacy of their homes or in their hearts, but doesn't need a public gathering space because it has no impact or relevance on public life. And there's nothing more the world around us, the government, or anyone else would want than for us to consider our faith a private, personal matter that makes no real difference in our world, that sort of just pushes Christianity to the margins as a docile, irrelevant, quiet hobby some people have that makes no real difference in the world, that it's just a private matter. But the truth is, Christianity is a threat to power. It's a threat to wealth, to systems of dominance and control. And so the more Christians retreat to the privacy of their homes only for worship, the more we appease people who ultimately want to rid of Christianity from the public consciousness and public life. Therefore, just the very simple act of gathering your physically being here right now is a prophetic act. It's an act of protest, telling the world, my faith is a very public matter, and it's important to me. It's why I love baptisms. These are the public expression that Jesus calls us to symbolize what has happened to us kind of privately. But Jesus says, you must publicly display that to people. It's why I wake up on Sunday morning and I get a little excited because I know we're going to make this prophetic act together of gathering together. And one of the main reasons we gather on Sunday is to honor publicly what Jesus did publicly for us. I mean, Jesus could have had some private death ceremony with just his closest friends and told them what it was going to mean, and then they could have taught everybody and told everybody about it. But he chose a very public act out in the marketplace, sort of, to show the world his truth by dying publicly on a cross. And we gather because what he did was so great, so meaningful to us, that it warrants a weekly public celebration to commemorate Jesus rising from the dead on Sunday morning. And that event is so great that its remembrance on Sunday has now continued for 2,000 years. So, church, let us remain strong and resolute. I mean, I hope you feel my heart here, right? This has nothing to do with church attendance and numbers. I mean, who cares about that? Like, there's not going to be a reward in heaven for those kinds of things. It has everything to do with the church being a strong, vital witness and force in the world, which it will never be if our worship becomes only a private exercise. And like the author of Hebrews, I don't want you to be deceived by teaching that says gathering together is not important. Rather, let's be wise and discerning in some of the things this can lead to and what's missing from a statement like that. So as the band comes to bless us in our endeavor to be the church scattered after being the church gathered, we're going to close by just blessing you in that task and endeavor to patiently sort out what is right, what is wrong, what leads to life, what leads to more glory for God in the world, and what does not in our lives. And we need wisdom for that. And so this is a song that the global church often kind of sung together when we were quite scattered, when we couldn't gather together for legitimate reasons. But now that we can be together, we can sing it and worship it together and receive it together. So we're going to sing this in closing, and then I'll just briefly dismiss us with a benediction. But whether you want to sit and receive this or you want to sing it and express it, that's fine. But the band...